From the House Committee on Human Services, February 25th, 2009, and I open up a work session on House Bill 2597.
And Representative Olson will just make the motion.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2597 without recommendation to the House Committee on Health Care with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Representative Olson moves House Bill 2597 without recommendation to the House Committee on Health Care with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Any discussion? Any objection? So moved. That's all I have to do, right?
I don't think we have to have a roll call.
Right. Okay. Passes. So this motion passes and the measure is sent to the Committee on Health Care with referral to Ways and Means. Thank you. Now I'm going to open up a public hearing and possible work session. I can give that all at once on HJR 15. Okay, Keely.
HJR 15 recognizes March as Maternal Mental Health Awareness Month, encourages the Early Childhood Council, health care providers, parents, and other stakeholders to increase understanding and awareness of the mental health needs of pregnant and postpartum women and their families. And I believe Wendy Davis is here too. Three of you? Okay.
Yes, please join us. And Wendy, I think you've given us something to read.
Have. We also emailed it if you want a little electronic copy.
Great. Welcome, and ladies.
Well, they look excited, Madam Chair.
I think so.
Yeah.
Go ahead. First thing we need you to introduce yourselves, just one at a time. Go ahead, Wendy.
I'm Wendy Davis, just my name. Okay, Wendy Davis, I'm in Portland.
You can introduce yourself and it's your turn to talk.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Tomei and members of the committee, I'm Wendy Davis, Dr. Wendy Davis in Portland, Oregon, and I have a private practice in psychotherapy. I'm also an educator and trainer and a relentless advocate for the mental health needs of pregnant postpartum women and their families. And I'm excited beyond belief to be here. I've been working and volunteering in this field for 14 years, and I'm very impressed with what Oregon has developed in the way that we are collaborating, the way that we're working across fields, clinicians, advocates, public health, researchers, and legislators. I want very much for this resolution to be part of our legislative record to recognize maternal mental health as an essential health care issue and need for our families will prevent crises related to the mental health needs of pregnant and postpartum women. What we know is that we know how to treat depression, anxiety, psychosis, bipolar disorders in pregnancy and postpartum. We do. We have wonderful resources. The biggest single obstacle to this treatment is the shame and fear and misinformation on the part of mothers themselves especially, but also on the part of providers, the media, and all of the systems involved. So what happens is that mothers, we can't treat them because they're afraid to reach out. What this resolution does is to make a public record to say this is a good thing to talk about. Over one out of eight of all pregnant postpartum women will have a serious depression or anxiety, and one in 500 will have psychosis. We don't talk about it. We're afraid. We have a taboo. And what this resolution does is to make public, to bring out of the shadows, that this is a common issue that can be treated. Women can recover and prevent isolation, alienation, and all the other issues that come with the results of mental illness during pregnancy or postpartum. Thank you.
Wendy did give us some written testimony, colleagues.
Hi,
Representative Tomei and members of the committee, thank you so much for allowing us to be here today. My name is Diane Solomon. I received my master's in science and nursing and became a certified nurse midwife long ago, I'm afraid to say, at Yale University. And after several years of practicing as a nurse midwife and delivering babies primarily at OHSU, I decided to go back and become a psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner, largely because the unmet needs of pregnant and postpartum women on the emotional and psychiatric front were frankly quite appalling to me. You'll see before you something I wrote about the costs of, I agree completely with Wendy, we cannot treat these people because A, they don't speak about it, and largely providers are not educated enough to recognize this. When I speak to them in groups, I tell them if they see 8 patients in a day and they don't pick up one psychiatric disorder in their pregnant and postpartum patients, they are missing it. And they are missing it. And they're missing it a lot. They have a busy clinic. I totally understand how it happens. I've been on the nurse midwifery end. But the idea of raising awareness so no one that cares for pregnant or postpartum women in this state is so critical. First of all, it will save untold costs in neonatal ICU admits, preterm labor, more C-sections, smaller head circumferences, worse Apgar scores, and all the problems that go along with that, including language and cognitive delays, emotional and psychiatric disorders as these babies grow, and an effect on the entire family. President Obama is absolutely correct when he says, if mama's happy, everybody's happy, and it's been proven over and over again. For that reason alone, this bill deserves to pass. And the other thing that I, as an Oregonian, take great pride in is the way our healthcare system has been on the cutting edge on very many issues. Take one great example, end-of-life care. We have moved the entire country with our focus on end-of-life care towards knowing better how to create a good death and how to take care of people at the end of their life. It's time for us now to move that to the beginning of life and make sure that everyone gets an excellent start. The mother's emotional and psychiatric needs are met, and we can do everything we can to prevent untold problems with that mother, her baby, her other children, and her spouse. Thank you so very much again.
Thank you very much. Representative Maurer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Thank you for coming today, and I have two questions. One is unrelated. How is that program at OHSU, because that's a relatively new one.
The nurse midwifery program?
No, your...
I am not at OHSU now. I am in private practice in downtown Portland.
But you had got your degree through OHSU?
Yes, it's a post-master certificate. It took me a year, and it's excellent.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Any further questions for this witness, Representative Van Orman?
Well, it could be a question for all of you. One of the things I absolutely agree with, increasing awareness of mental health, period, because I think it is a tragedy in our society that it is in the dark. But one of the things that I was curious about in line 24, it talks about encouraging the early childhood council to address perinatal mental health. We have a number of programs that are such as Healthy Start, which are already involved in identifying those potential risks of women. And then Head Start is also doing work with families. So I want to be sure that the Early Childhood Council is sufficient to support what they're trying to do. And I guess I'd like to see some mention of some of the programs that are already doing something. So if you wouldn't mind responding to that.
Oh, it's a wonderful question, Representative Van Orman. I hope that we'll also be able to kind of finish the conversation on March 16th when we have the hearing for House bill that talks about creating a task force. In this resolution, I chaired the little work group that put together the legislative proposals here. And in this resolution, what we wanted to do was to mention the Early Childhood Council because it could be a kind of an umbrella to incorporate all of the different stakeholders working in infant and child health care and mental health and the health care of new mothers. But you're absolutely right, and that's part of the exciting thing that's happening in Oregon is that Head Start, Healthy Start, a lot of public health, a lot of support for new mothers have been working and getting more and more training. And what this resolution does is to really make it on the record legislatively that families, all of these groups, as you mentioned, and the legislation and researchers are really now publicly working together on this. So I really appreciate that question to make sure that we are bringing in all of the stakeholders, to use the buzzword, but we do all have a stake in this. And communicating not only with the Head Start, Healthy Start, public health, but bringing families and providers into the conversation.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Go ahead. Thank you, Wendy.
My name is Sheila Andor, and I'm from Corvallis. Chair Tomei and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify before you today. I am here to support this resolution. I am the executive director of a small organization called Well Mama. that I started a couple years ago, where we have volunteers and myself and another social worker. We provide free phone support and support groups to perinatal families where the mother suffers from perinatal mood or anxiety disorders. I'm also co-coordinator for Postpartum Support International in Oregon along with Wendy Davis. And I am also a psychotherapist with a social work background, and I specialize in reproductive health-related concerns, work in Eugene and Corvallis. I am also a survivor of postpartum depression and perinatal anxiety disorders. I am one of the examples of all the women that we talk about. Though my birth was out of state, I only moved here a couple of years ago, but the situation in this state is just the same. I had severe depression, panic attacks, post-traumatic stress. I became suicidal a few months postpartum, and I was a licensed clinician at that time, and I had no idea what was happening to me. And I ended up diagnosing myself online and found my way to Postpartum Support International, and then eventually started support groups and providing support to moms on the phone, which I have continued doing when I moved to Oregon. And now I started the nonprofit. We are in the process of becoming a nonprofit and planning to expand our services. In course of my work, which you can also read in my statement, I have observed a widespread lack of awareness among social service providers and medical health care providers about maternal and perinatal mental health issues. Even providers who care and who have special passion and would like to be more helpful to women and families in these issues just don't have the information. All of the women, with very, very few exceptions that I have worked with, told me that they had not heard about any of these conditions. They had not been screened. They never received a pamphlet about perinatal depression. And I have worked with over 300 women through my support groups and phone support over the course of the past 5 years since I suffered my own course of perinatal mood disorders. I very much support this resolution, and I thank you all for having us today.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
You've had a background in psychotherapy, and you said you self-diagnosed. Were you able to self-diagnose because of your background, or have you had the psychotherapy training since the postpartum depression? Which came first?
What happened was that I had to make the very long story short, a baby who was in the NICU for a long time, which was part of my depression and post-traumatic stress and all of that. I ended up leaving my social work job, starting a private practice, and I thought I would work with parents who have a child in the NICU. And as I was telling my friends about this endeavor, somebody told me, oh, gee, you could also treat postpartum depression then. That was the first time I heard that term, and I was a licensed clinical social worker. I thought postpartum depression. I Googled it, and that's how I self-diagnosed myself.
Wow.
Follow up, Madam
Follow
Chair.
Follow up.
Women in general, if you can categorize, are they aware that something is really wrong, or is it just, okay, I'm just kind of depressed? Do they not take it as seriously as it really is?
I'd like to answer that, because often they will come crawling to my office at 2 or 4 months when finally their provider realizes that something's wrong, even though it may have been going on since 2 weeks, because they don't want to tell anyone. And it's not until they start really not looking like themselves that someone will pick it up, because there is much fear and shame, and they will not mention it. And if no one asks them, they don't know. They know that they're not feeling well, but there's a myth in America that every new mother is happy and this is what she's always wanted and this is the best time of her life. And they feel incredible guilt and shame, and they don't want to mention it. And if nobody else does, it doesn't get picked up. And furthermore, what I find, straddling the obstetric and the psychiatric community, both of which I have incredible respect for and collaborate with, obstetricians and even nurse midwives are very reticent to use psychiatric medications and treat this. And then on the other side, most psychiatric nurse practitioners and psychiatrists who can prescribe, as well as psychotherapists, as we all are also very reticent to get involved with someone who's pregnant or breastfeeding. So there are few providers, a huge gap in care, and an just untold number of women who are just suffering, and unless someone says to them postpartum depression, or another mother breaks the shame cycle and says, you know, what you're talking about sounds like what happened to me. I did A, B, and C. They're just suffering in silence.
Madam Chair, can I also respond to that?
I really appreciate your question very much, Representative Huffman, and I can tell you to go along with that and also follow up what Sheila said. I was also a clinician for 14 years when I had my first child and landed in the world of postpartum depression and anxiety. So I had a doctorate in psychology, and I had no idea what was going on. So your question is excellent. I did have a very good idea. I thought I'd made a mistake. I thought I shouldn't have been a mother. I was embarrassed. I'm a therapist. I'm a queen of talk about it. And I wouldn't tell anyone, especially my husband, who looked like he was having such a good time. He was so proud and happy. So I didn't tell him. I was suicidal. I lost all my weight. I wasn't eating. I wasn't sleeping. And in England, this is called the smiling depression, because we can pull it together, because we're overachievers. risk factor. We want very much to be good mamas. We're not, it's not, when you think postpartum depression, you get an image of a crying, kind of neglectful mom. That's not who's at risk. We have high achievers, self-sufficient, very good mamas who are trying very hard. When they're home alone with their babies, they may spend a lot of time crying, anxious, disconnected. Do they know something's wrong? Yes. They blame themselves. If they've never heard, as we're trying to get across with this resolution, they've never heard the words, they've never heard this happens commonly, you're not alone, you'll get better. There is no way in the state of depression, anxiety, or certainly psychosis, to understand that this is diagnosable, treatable, no shame, and it's something to talk about. So, thank you.
One more, please. Just briefly, if that's possible, can you give me a glimpse of the road to recovery? Drugs, hormone therapy, what?
I would say very, very broadly, we have to treat the physical with whatever treatment and remedies work for that woman as long as she's treating those symptoms to help her get better. Physical, emotional support, social support, so she can have breaks. And family support around her, and access to health care.
Is there anything with hormone?
There are those treatments, but it's not required. And just to make that long story short, there are a lot of different physical treatments, hormonal medication, and that's between the woman and her provider, her health care system, to make sure she's getting good treatment.
The reason I ask that, because oftentimes I think we're left with the impression that, oh, it's a hormonal imbalance. Oftentimes, and so I wanted to clarify that there, it may be more than that. So,
thank you. Representative Mauer.
Madam Chair, I'll keep this short. Actually, Representative Huffman answered most of the questions, but it's about the assessment. My experience, of course, is as a father of four, and going, my wife is also a nurse practitioner and been in practice for a number of years. And we heard this back 15 years ago. I mean, we this was a topic of conversation 15 years ago. So the question is, are the providers, whether it's family practice or whoever is doing the prenatal care, if you have it, if you're lucky enough to have prenatal care, are they not having the conversation with the patient? And then the follow-up to that is how is there a very good assessment tool afterwards, and how does I don't care who answers.
And now it's your name, so that the
Diane Solomon.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Moore. One of the problems is all of these providers are in a very busy clinic setting. When I was a nurse midwife at OHSU, if someone, this was going back 20 years ago or more, if someone would start bringing up pregnancy or postpartum depression to me, I would practically go, because I didn't know how to treat it. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what resources were out there, and I had someone waiting in the next room for me to see them. So I completely understand the position of the providers. What I try to bring across to them when I speak to them and try to train them about not only meds, but psychosocial support, which is the A1 biggest preventor of pregnancy and postpartum anxiety and depression, meaning family support, which very few women have today. We throw them out there to go home alone with this baby, the absolute worst prescription we could possibly think up. And even one relationship with a good provider that really understands them is going to change the whole course. And all of these providers are well-meaning. You don't go into psychiatry or obstetrics without being very well-meaning. However, what I try to bring across is there is a tool. It's a fabulous tool. It works very well. It's called the EPDS, the Edinburgh Postnatal Depression Scale. And I encourage the person who puts the woman in the clinic room, I encourage the provider to get that person to give them this one sheet of paper that will take them 2 minutes, at least in every trimester, 2 weeks postpartum, and then every time they see them postpartum until they're confident they're out of the woods. If this screen comes up positive, they don't have to fix it. They have to say, wow, it looks like this is sort of a high score. Maybe you'd like to talk to someone. Here are some names. So it doesn't need to take a lot of time. It can be done very efficiently, but it's a great way for both the patient and the provider to know, wow, there really is a problem here. The woman knows I'm not alone. There's a scale directly targeted towards people like me. There must be a lot of us. And then they can be routed to the appropriate care.
Thank you.
Thank you for your question, Representative Moore. Just wanted to add one.
What is your name again?
I'm sorry, Sheila Andor. And just wanted to add to what Diane said, that at that point when the physician or the provider identifies a positive score, the big issue is what names or clinics to give out, and we don't have a system for this in Oregon. And we're hoping that this resolution will be the first step in a bigger picture that will lead to a network in the state where we have referrals to give out to.
Great, thank you. A couple of things I want to bring up. I'd like to have a copy of that, of the
absolutely. Edinburgh postnatal EPDS.
So that I could pass out to the members here. And you are having a conference soon?
I'm so glad you mentioned that, Rep. Tomei.
It's very soon. Next Thursday, March 5th, we're having our first statewide symposium here in Salem. And it's co-sponsored by the Department of Health and our Oregon Infant Mental Health Association. It's collaborative. It's across all of professions and advocates. We opened registration about, I don't know, a month ago. 290 people have signed up, and we're very thrilled. We're very excited to imagine that this resolution could be read the same day of that symposium, and that we can tell these providers we're going to have statewide support, a network, and also tell our survivors panel who's coming to speak, we're with you, we're behind you, this is getting better, this isn't lip service, this is real progress. So someone said to me their favorite day of the year is March 4th. And that's because you can march forth. And I'm very excited. It really is how it feels to me. And we've been walking for a long time. And we're really, really thrilled to have a statewide symposium and to be here in the legislature to really address this issue together.
Thank you, Wendy. And colleagues, I want to let you know how I got involved with this issue. Some of you know that last summer I went to Harvard early childhood development program, and so several of us went, several who had been on this committee are now gone, but and Erin Kelly Seal, and it was fascinating, and it was about children and early development. And so the earliest development, of course, is the most important. So nobody has talked about that yet, and I'm not sure that there's going to be anybody who is prepared to talk about, because the effect on the infant is incredible.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been talking here about the effect on the mother, but the effect on mm-hmm. the infant is just extremely important that we need to address. So, Representative Van Orman, I think
I just had one question, Madam Chair. Thank you. Is this preventable?
We can always, Rep. Van Orman, we can always prevent a crisis. We can't prevent symptoms.
Okay.
But the point of that is, well, you can't prevent the symptoms of a sore throat when you're getting the virus. So 2009, we can't prevent that you're going to encounter the germs. We can prevent that you're going to get sicker. We're going to prevent that people are afraid, isolated, and don't reach out. We can prevent a crisis like suicide, infanticide. We really can, especially if we have education ahead of time. We can prevent damage to the fetus and to the infant.
Okay.
And we can definitely prevent, Representative Van Orman, subsequent occurrences. We know this is a disorder that progresses in each pregnancy. It'll start earlier, typically, and it's worse than the time before. So once we have a woman in our system, she becomes so well educated that she knows as soon as she gets pregnant the next time, she's going to access care again to prevent all of this from recurring.
Representative Van Orman, we can also prevent multiple ER admissions, mm-hmm. because that's what happens now.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, ladies. Thank you for coming, and thank you for being willing to share the information that you have and your own experiences with us.
Thank you so much for listening.
And I'm not sure if people have signed up, but I see some. That's okay. That if you didn't sign up, just come on up. Joanne, did you want to testify? I know that you did. That's great. So anybody else who's wanting to testify on this issue, please do come up.
Chair, is someone going to address the effects on the
chair?
Yes, I think. Oh, okay.
Please identify yourself for the record.
Sure.
Good morning, Rep. Tomei and members of the committee. I'm sorry, I should know better. My name is Kate Wilcox. I'm the Maternal and Child Health Section Manager at the Oregon Public Health Division. However, this is my first time testifying in front of a committee, so pardon my blunder for not signing up, but I'm thrilled to be here to chat with you all today. As you've heard from the panel of the experts, this issue of maternal mental disorders is pretty widespread. It includes a whole range from mood disorders to depression to anxiety to even suicide attempts during and after pregnancy. It is a major public health issue. In Oregon, 23% of new moms, nearly one in four, are affected by maternal mental health disorders. 18% are during pregnancy, about 11% are postpartum. And it's higher among a lot of the populations that we at DHS serve. Low-income, minority, young mothers. For example, 32% of poor mothers reported symptoms as compared to only 14% of non-poor mothers. And you can imagine what exacerbates some of that with the stresses that come along with poverty and being a young new mom. They've talked a lot about the impact on the woman. I just want to mention, I don't have as much data as I would like, and I'm happy to get it for you, but there are severe impacts as well, as Chair Tomei has referenced, on the child. Those early weeks and months of bonding and attachment with the child can be greatly affected by the fact that the mother is experiencing some sort of a depressive condition, and as well as the parenting of that newborn. And children subsequently have higher rates of physical, behavioral, cognitive, and developmental problems as a result of this. As they've said, it can be successfully treated, but the stigma and the lack of provider information and the lack of referral networks that they alluded to are real problems that have kept this issue from really being out there. The public awareness is also another part of this. So we are thrilled with House Joint Resolution 15 that we hope will shed light on this critical public health issue, as well as support and unite the pockets of work that are happening around Oregon. For example, and I'm going to relate back to the symposium that was mentioned before, in November of 2007, state and local public health leaders in maternal and child health held a retreat, a leadership retreat, and identified two priority areas that we wanted to work on over the next 3 years. And perinatal depression or maternal mental health disorders was one of those two. We then spent the next 6 weeks, a work group, developing a 3-year public health action plan that maps out a strategy for coordinated efforts to improve maternal mental health in Oregon. And it includes developing partnerships, educating providers, screening and referral of clients, research, funding and resource development, infant mother intervention programs, and community support services. And our intent is really to engage all of the players, and the Early Childhood Council is one of the major players of that. An outcome of the action plan was our March 5th symposium on maternal mental health during and after pregnancy, and we're very excited that this is happening. It is co-sponsored by the Public Health Division and the Oregon Mental Health Association. Over 270 registered participants have registered already. We have a cap of 300, and we anticipate we're going to hit that before we close registration on Friday. But they include professionals from health, public health, mental health, early childhood systems and arenas, as well as policymakers, community advocates, health system representatives, and we're really looking forward to sharing and learning the network and the partnership building. We have Wendy as one of our keynote speakers. speakers, as well as Dr. Laura Miller from Chicago, who will share the Illinois experience. They're seen as one of the leaders in the country about how they've been able to create a statewide network and support for providers and women and their families. So we're quite excited that this joint House joint resolution would support even more awareness of the critical issue and make this March one that all of us who are mothers would remember. As public servants, you probably have experienced that your professional and your personal lives intersect from time to time. I'm a new mother for the second time as of November, and this morning as I was dropping my children off at daycare at 6:30 in the morning, my older daughter said, "Why are we doing this?" And I said, "Well, I need to go and talk to some people down in Salem who are going to help." And she said, "Help what?" And I said, "Well, remember when we brought your daughter or your sister home from China in November? And I wasn't really the nicest mom then, was I?" And she goes, "No, you really weren't." And I said, "Well, these people are going to do something to help our moms be better moms." And she said, "Oh, that's a really good thing." So from the voice of my six-year-old, it's a really good thing. And I think it also plays to what Representative Huffman was alluding to, that it's not just the hormones. It's also the emotional and the behavioral and the situational environment that contributes to that. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions or be a resource for the committee if they have further questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Kate. And Kate, I'm not sure that anybody, is there anybody else who is wanting to testify on this? Apparently not. So from somebody, I would like to have some studies that show the effect on infants when a mother is depressed.
Absolutely.
Because
we can get you that
just
information.
Astounding information.
Mm-hmm. We can get you that information.
Great. Thank you.
Chair.
Okay. Yes. Thank you, Representative
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a question that I probably should have asked the previous panel, but maybe you can help with it. I'm wondering if there's a connection between birth settings and postpartum depression. You know, I'm just thinking my own children. My son was born in this country, and he was they left the hospital within 24 hours. And my daughter was born in France, and there mothers are required to stay in hospital for, I think, 5 to 7 days. In hospital is the wrong term. It was a birth clinic.
Mm-hmm.
The hospital, I'm not sure that we would have wanted to stay there more than 24 hours, you know, to be honest. The birth clinic was a much more supportive kind of environment. But I think a lot of what they were doing deliberately was keeping an eye on the mother, working with her, seeing how she was dealing with lactation, things like that. And that was really a kind of a follow-up to a prenatal program that included a lot of, counseling and bioenergetics, things like that, which were just kind of natural to a normal part of the routine. And I'm just wondering if people are talking about the birth center. I probably should have asked Ms. Holland this.
Yeah, Chair Tomei and Rep. Debrow, I think they are the experts more on this than I would be, so I don't know if you want to respond.
Would one of you like to come up and respond to that? Thank you. And please announce your name again.
Thank you, Representative Tomei and Representative Debrow. My name is Diane Solomon. I am so glad you brought up this question, because in the letter that I included, I cited the French model. Not only do they educate women during pregnancy as an incredibly preventive measure that empowers the women and makes them feel ready and brings in that psychosocial piece that's so critical to preventing problems. Then, when the woman does get home, she gets a year of paid leave, as you probably know, and she gets 3 months of paid doula care. So there is a woman, this is what I honestly want in Oregon, because it will make such a difference. There's a woman that comes into the house frequently, several times a week in those first 3 months, helps with breastfeeding, helps understanding baby variations, normal and not, helps keep an eye on the pulse of the woman. That's how it should be done. And you're absolutely correct. In fact, there is a growing international movement that I like to call Do We Scare Because We Care, about how the medicalization of pregnancy and childbirth, especially here in America, creates a lot of anxiety that then fulminates. And actually, it's quite deleterious to the fetus and the newborn, that anxiety. They're living in an amniotic, high-stress soup before they're even born. And the birth environment does not help at all. The French model is much better. And many other models are much better. Our model, again, is perhaps the worst that might be imagined. It's very technical. There's lots of different people. It's very medicalized. And then you throw the woman back to her home. And, yes, I mean, there's a growing movement internationally in studies about this. But what's interesting is all over Europe they're studying it. Even in Turkey they're studying it. Elsewhere they're studying it. Thailand, I saw a great study from Thailand. It's not being studied in the United States. It's not even recognized yet as a problem.
Thank you.
Thank you.
One quick question. We need to move on.
I just wanted to ask, Kate, mm-hmm. You mentioned emotional, situational, and behavioral are also indicators or causes. Could that be from someone else living in the home situation there? If that's, for example, if there's a mental health situation there or something, would that cause?
Well, again, I'm not the, Rep. Tomei and Rep. Boone, I'm sorry. I'm not the expert clinically, but my experience would say that that would be certainly a contributing factor. But
yes, it's very much a contributing factor, but the reverse is more of a factor. The woman who is anxious and depressed affects everyone else in the family and brings the whole family down. It's been shown over and over again. Yes, if there are any psychosocial factors that were pre-existent or occur right after the birth of the child are going to be predisposing risk factors for postpartum anxiety or depression. But the opposite is what's more, and the opposite is probably what's even more common.
Thank you so much. Is there anyone else who wishes to speak on this issue? Yes, Representative.
I'm sorry.
That's
this,
okay.
This
do you have something to ask?
I do.
Okay,
this is a great conversation. My question, in the U.S., actually, World Health Organization recognizes hospitals. First off, pregnancy is not a disease, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Your wife like has educated you well.
World Health Organization recognizes hospitals as baby-friendly, and they go through a process. And how many hospitals in Oregon are there that are baby-friendly?
I have no idea. I've never even heard that term, so I'm afraid to say.
Okay.
I would suspect.
I have, and but I don't know, and I could find out.
And there's also another designation called mother-friendly hospitals.
Yes.
Right.
And I think there's only been maybe one or two hospitals in the United States that have... Right. One of them, which is in Grants Pass, Oregon.
The other one. Let's see, where did he come from?
Yeah.
Thank you, Representative. And for those of you who came here to testify on this today, we'd like a lot more information on this issue. Please educate us, and if you can send it by email, that probably that's best. But if you need snail mail, do that too. This is an issue I hope that we will be dealing with throughout this session and probably in future sessions. I think this is an extremely important issue, both for the mother, for the rest of the family, and most decidedly for the infant. So,
our PowerPoint slides okay to email?
Sure.
Thank you so much. We can't tell you how much we appreciate this.
Thank you. Madam Chair, just, you know, as you're collecting information, I'm also interested in the role of the father in this whole phenomenon, you know, just reinforcing problems, alleviating problems, you know, et cetera.
Or having problems of his own.
Right.
And there is still room at the symposium if you'd like to.
Not much. Better sign up today.
In fact, colleagues, I would love to go to the symposium, but because of my commitments here, I can't. But I am sending one of my staff. And if there is interest in your office, you might want to consider sending a staff person. I think
Rep. Tomei, it is, and Rep. Boone, it's March 5th, and it's here in Salem at the Red Lion Inn over by I-5. And we are almost at capacity, but
you know, we would certainly make room.
Thank you again. Thank you, Wendy.
Thank you very much.
It is the 5th, because initially they said the 4th.
But it is the 5th, correct?
Yeah. Thursday.
Yeah. 5th, a week from tomorrow. Okay, we're going to close the public hearing.
Yes, close the public hearing
on HJR 15.
Madam Chair, I move HJR 15 to the floor with a due adopted recommendation.
Thank you, Representative
Boone. To be adopted, I'm sorry.
Boone moves HGR 15 to the floor with an adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? I don't think we need a roll call, do you? Does anybody need a roll call? All right. The motion passes, and HGR 15 is adopted and sent to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Thank you, committee, and thanks to those who came to testify. And thanks, for Joanne, for your testimony also. So we're going to open up a work session on 2050. Yes.
We're going to have a carrier on that, Madam Chair.
Oh, thank you. I think I want to carry that.
I was going to say, why don't you,
Madam
Chair?
Yeah, I will carry that.
You
thank
can
you.
Do that.
Yeah. Unless, did you have some pieces on?
No. I think you'd be perfect.
Okay. Absolutely. I think I'd be a good carrier, too. Okay, so now what am I opening up? I already said 20 work session on 2050. Okay, Keely.
This measure extends the time to establish a caregiver relationship between a juvenile and an unrelated foster parent from 6 months to 12 months. And Kevin George is here from DHS if we have additional questions.
Great. Kevin?
Good morning, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. My name is Kevin George, and I work as the foster care program manager at the Department of Human Services. We had a hearing here about 2 weeks ago, and I did a pretty good job of confusing folks, I think, by spouting off a number of statutes. And so the written information we provided was an attempt to actually put those statutes on paper and let you see the intersection between all of these statutes on intervener status.
Right. So, any discussion on this issue?
No, Madam Chair. Other than just to refresh, because...
Right. So, colleagues, this came up as a result of a committee that Representative Maurer and I were on that met for... And were you there, too?
I was not.
That met for several months. And this was also with several other representatives and a couple of senators, with several judges throughout the state, and CASAs. Who else was there? Representative Maurer.
Yeah, Representative Krieger, too, was there.
Oh, yes. Representative Krieger was very active in this group. Mm-hmm. And that we met at the Supreme Court Justice's offices. This was an issue regarding adoption and whether or not a foster family could reach the same position of being equal in terms of adoption as a birth family after 6 months. And so the consensus of the group was that it should be 12 months. And this was after, as I say, many meetings, hearing a lot of different opinions, but this was consensus. Would you agree
with
that?
And the history is that it started at... If you can get the history, it's gone up and down. And
right.
Certainly, Chair Tomei and Representative Maurer, at one point in time, certainly in my career with DHS, Department of Human Services, I've been a caseworker and worked my way up through management structure for 18 years. And so at one point in time, it was 30 months. It went down to 18 months. It changed to 12 months. It went down to 6 months. And now the request is to move it back to 12. And when Representative Krieger and Representative Schaffler and Senator Cruz came and testified, what they were really trying to say is, look, we may have gone too far on this, and going back to say we need to have a difference between relative preference and non-related people for children.
And my only comment is that there is no perfect time, and that this truly is something that, you know, we are going to now create a new problem, but maybe alleviate some, and maybe we'll have fewer problems at 12 months than we did at 6. But I'm not sure we are ever going to find, quote, the sweet spot and totally fix it, because this is bad. But 6 wasn't working.
Right, right. And there were lots of other issues that we dealt with regarding adoptions, and the department has been most cooperative and have made a lot of changes through rule. We didn't have to do it legislatively. So I felt really good about the process that we went through, and I feel really good about this bill. So any further questions or concerns? All right.
Okay, well, Madam Chair, I move that House Bill 2050 be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Olson moves that House Bill 2050 move to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Seeing none, let's call the roll on this one. You can start the top of the alphabet this time, Zach.
Representative Collins?
Yes.
Representative Dimbro?
Aye.
Representative Freeman?
Aye.
Representative Huffman?
Aye.
Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Van Orman?
Aye.
Representative Boone?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Yes.
Chair Comey?
Aye. Thank you. Having received the majority, House Bill 2050 passes. And yes, and Representative Maurer, would you carry this bill?
Yes, I will carry it.
Great.
I'm going to ask Krieger and Schaffler also to speak on it.
Because that's terrific. Great idea. Good. Thank you. All right. Close the public hearing and work session on House Bill 2050. And I will open up a work session or a public hearing on 2443 and 2448. Is that what I'm supposed to do, ma'am?
Ma'am.
All righty.
House Bill 2443 creates a task force on public guardianship for vulnerable adults. It details the composition and responsibilities of the task force, directs Department of Human Services to provide staff support for the task force, and requires a report to the Legislative Assembly with recommendations for further legislation. House Bill 2448 creates a sliding tax credit for adoption expenses based on income eligibility and specifically qualified adoptions, especially related to children who are over the age of 3, groups of siblings who are adopted together, and disabled or chronically ill children.
Great.
And Chris has gone. There she is.
Oh, Representative Gelser, next slide.
How are you feeling? I'm holding in there.
Welcome.
Thank you. Which one are we talking about?
2443 and 2448.
Great. Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I am Representative Sarah Gelser, and the good news I have for you is your work with me is almost done. So I do miss serving on this committee, and it's perhaps my sneaky way of trying to rejoin you every day. House Bill 2443 would create a task force on public guardianships for vulnerable adults, although it would focus specifically on individuals with developmental disabilities. One of the things I've learned over the past several months is that there is a lot of interest in guardianships of all kinds, public guardianships, private guardianships, all guardianships, and I've been, sorry, I'm out of breath from coming down from the revenue room. Many people are interested in guardianships, and many have approached about being included in this bill. And there's two reasons why I have been resistant to adding other groups to the bill. The first is that people with developmental disabilities have, no, thank you, people with developmental disabilities have very unique needs when it comes to guardianships that are very different than the needs, for example, of seniors or veterans that have experienced a serious injury while they're away. Often people with developmental disabilities come into a guardianship situation due to abuse or neglect, and there are rarely very many financial assets that need to be dealt with. There are also some specific and unusual policy questions that have come up recently, including the challenge of if you have a child with a developmental disability who's been removed from their family due to abuse or neglect, how do you make sure that those same individuals who are abusive and neglectful aren't then, after the child ages out of foster care,
mother named the guardians of that same individual who is still quite vulnerable. So I think it would be very frustrating to members of a task force to be bogged down in issues that are very specific to a specific group, and that's why I proposed one that was all on its own. The second reason that I have been resistant is that I would recommend that you not move this bill forward. I think that it is a very important issue that needs to be addressed, but clearly the economic situation that we have right now, even task forces are very expensive as we're looking at cutting services to vulnerable Oregonians. There are nonprofit organizations. I think Catherine White's going to talk to you a little bit about this to see how we might pull this together through the nonprofit sector and hopefully come back to your committee in the interim with any policy recommendations that that group might have, and avoiding the need to use any public resources to get people together to come up with good ideas and policy suggestions. So with that, on House Bill 2443, I would say it's a good idea, but I would not recommend that you move it forward because I don't think that we can pay for it at this time, and there may be other ways that we can accomplish its ends.
Okay, thank you, Representative. Do you want to talk while you're here about 2448? I opened up both.
Yes, please. Thank you very much. Do I need to do the record thing again, or can I just... So for the record, I'm Representative Sarah Gelser from House District 16, Corvallis and Philomath. House Bill 2448 would reestablish the expired adoption tax credit. It expired in 2006, and we had this bill, not this precise bill, but a similar bill last session that ran out of time, and what this did was allow a tax credit for Oregonians who were adopting children to help defray actual and credible adoption expenses. And if you're a family that's looking to adopt a child, if you think about when you grow your family and you have health insurance, having a baby is very expensive, but your health insurance helps to defray that cost. The same is not true for adoption, even though you may still be paying the medical costs and other costs of adopting a child. And for many working families, that can put the dream of becoming a mother and a father out of reach for them. And this would help to ease that. What this bill does that's different than the previously existing tax is that it phases it out at a lower income level, and it puts a preferential incentive in the tax credit to adopt children that are frequently considered more difficult to adopt. So if you are a taxpayer and your family's gross income does not exceed $150,000 and you adopt any random child, newborn child from anywhere, your tax credit would be, I believe, $2,500. Is that correct? I believe that it's $2,500. If you are an individual and your gross income does not exceed $250,000, you would have an enhanced $5,000 tax credit that would be available to you if you adopted a special needs child. And a special needs child would be a child that is over the age of 3 at the time of adoption, if that child hasn't been living with you since birth, a child with a diagnosed long-term disability or chronic illness, or a sibling set of 3 or more. This is a significant change from the previously existing tax credit, which you did not get these credits if you were adopting a child out of the foster care system, and this does create some incentive to reduce, to be able to achieve permanency for kids that are legally free but living in foster care, but it's hard to find families for them.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions, Representative?
I do. Thanks, Rep. Gelser. Does this include people who travel overseas to and their travel expenses to get a child to adopt?
Yes, it does.
And follow-up? Can you tell me what, you know, how much impact that's going to be?
Madam Chair, Representative Boone, I'm not sure what the specific impact would be. When we heard this bill last time, the fiscal impact was not tremendous, and it did include those families. I worked in the interim with Gary Conkling, who represents Holt International, and we did discuss, and I had raised the issue of should we be focused specifically on domestic adoption as opposed to international adoption, and it did start to become kind of tricky as you started talking about different kinds of children or different kinds of families where you were doing adoptions, and many agencies and others that are advising and helping families to do these things are doing both domestic and international adoption. So it seemed easier just to lump all adoptive families together and focus that enhancement on the special needs of the child, and also really carefully limiting the income levels of people that would be eligible for the credit.
Follow up?
Just a comment. I know I will be asked this question, so I'm asking you for the right response. And that is that why would we be allowing a tax credit for someone to go out of our state or even out of our country to bring a child in for adoption rather than trying to incentivize adopting Oregon's children who need a home?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Boone. That was a question that I also asked. And I think that it came back to two things. One, I think that this bill does significantly restructure the way that adoption credits have been done in the past by providing that enhanced incentive to adopt a child from within our state foster care system. I think that the second answer to that question that I got was, would we then limit it to people only that were adopting Oregon children, as opposed to a child that happened to be born in Washington or Idaho or California, if we were looking at Oregon children. And I think finally where I settled on it was that adoption is a good thing, and lots of different people have lots of different things that they think about when they go to adopt a child. And for some families, adopting a child from within the United States, where you may or may not have ongoing contact with birth families, is a wonderful thing that their families are very comfortable doing. Or adopting a special needs child through foster care is something they're very comfortable doing. For some families, they aren't. And when they aren't, that does not become a good thing for that family or for that child. So ultimately, I think what this is about is providing some incentive and assistance to families that want to become parents, that ultimately are going to be providing a loving home for a child that needs a loving and safe home, regardless of whether they were born in India or Corvallis. And this bill ultimately does that. I think those questions are there, and I've struggled with that question. But I think that will be the minority of these credits.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Gelser, no offense or anything, but I guess I'm thinking, let's focus on and try to solve the problems of Oregon and not the world. And I think that's kind of where I would come on. I think it's a great idea, and incentivizing the opportunity to help foster kids and the DHS adoption program. But I'd like to focus on Oregon myself.
Gee.
Thank you. Thank
you. You don't
Madam
need
Chair.
To respond.
Okay. To that. No, I appreciate that. Madam Chair, Representative Huffman, the one thing that I would point out is that how this does help Oregonians is that the parents are, in fact, Oregonians, many of whom have, from the time they were children, looked forward to growing up and raising a family. And for some of them, raising that family due to medical reasons is something that's out of reach to them. And whether it's cultural, financial, or whatever other reasons, they can't be safe or healthy parents to a child they adopt through the foster care system. We're addressing that issue for those families by making it possible for them to realize that dream of parenthood.
Thank you. One of your last question? All right.
Oh, did you have, you look like you're thinking.
Well, I'm struggling because I am with Representative Gelser on conflict here. And I think the question that I have is relative to supporting this adoption with tax dollars, with the awareness that these children will be in our systems of public education and will be a more expensive student. And so I'm struggling with the cost. And, you know, in 2443 we pulled off because we don't have dollars. So I guess it's not a question, Representative Gelser, but it certainly is. I'm just as conflicted as you and Representative Huffman seem to be on this.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Representative Van Orman, one of the reasons that this bill, last time the bill was referred directly to revenue and it did not come to the Human Services Committee for a policy discussion, and I would offer that certainly if you choose to move this bill onto revenue is a policy discussion for you all to have. I leave that to all of you. I would also say that I came before you with another tax credit option a couple of days ago. If I personally had to prioritize which one was my priority for you to move forward, it would probably be it probably would be that other one that had to do with the child abuse assessments. I do believe there are a lot of families that this impacts. When we heard this bill in revenue last time, the hearing room filled, and there were no sponsors of the bill, so it wasn't. It was a pre-session filed bill at the request of the Oregon Law Commission, I believe, and many, many people in Oregon have a significant concern about this issue.
Concern?
That they would like to see it reinstated. This credit, in a more expansive way than is expressed in this bill, was in existence until 2006. It's also consistent with there's a federal tax credit for the first $10,000 of allowable adoption expenses. This would be on top of that. And for some families, that got them almost all the way there to be able to pay their adoption expenses.
Thank you. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think we kind of touched on this and heard some testimony recently, if you could refresh my memory. The situation with, my concern right now, DHS, and the adoption process, and is there a significant need right now for adoptive parents, or is there a waiting list, or what's the status of that?
Do we have anybody here from DHS?
Kevin probably could have answered that, but he's gone.
My memory is, and we can get that information for all of us, my memory is that infants, there usually are a lot more families willing to adopt infants mm-hmm. than there are, as Representative Gelser was mentioning, some of the older children and also children with special needs. Very often they end up in foster care because it's too difficult, very difficult to find appropriate homes for them. But we'll get that information for you. I just want to point out, colleagues, that I think this is a very important issue, but because of the financial situation that we're in right now, I think starting up a new or reinstating a program that we had seen in past years that was a very effective, good program, I think would have a very slim chance, and I think Representative Gelser would acknowledge that. But I think it's important to have this discussion, and hopefully I'll have a lot of the same, and hopefully I will be here next session, and that we might be having this discussion again when we might want to be thinking about this tax credit. On top of that, Representative Huffman, do you have another question or comment?
Well, we all know, whether it's post-World War II and needing to build the economy and population base, et cetera, and so on, you know, through incentives, we have everything from childbirth to moving people into the right geographical locations. We do it through tax credits and whatnot. And I think it's probably a real need that we need to look at and address. And if it was a successful program through 2006, then there's apparently a great need there. Mm-hmm. I was just wondering if we did narrow the focus to Oregon's need, and maybe, you know, if that could make a financial difference. I mean, I could see an enormous difference in fiscal impact between just focusing on Oregon as opposed to the world. I mean, I could see huge financial differences in that. So I didn't know if that would make a difference in proceeding if we narrowed the scope.
Thank you, Representative Huffman. Representative Dimbro.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just, I have a process question. This is the third or fourth bill that has included tax credits. And so are we going to be treating them the same way that we're treating revenue bills? That is, we're going to wait a while and kind of choose among them as to which ones we're passing on to revenue?
That's correct. And we've been, as I mentioned, I think early in our committee sessions, that we've been given the marching orders not to send anything further unless we absolutely want them to pass in the financial climate that we're in now. So
ultimately, we'll see this one among a list of others, and we'll be picking and choosing from them.
That's right. And in the past, if we did not take a strong stand on a bill, it would go, as those of us who served in previous terms, it would go to Ways and Means to Die. We're not doing that anymore. That's sort of what you're getting at. Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Since we are going to be talking a little bit about the fiscal stuff, has anybody looked at the cost savings by having people out of the foster care program and finally adopted and off any sort of assistance there? And it might be a cost shift that is actually cheaper to get people So if, I mean, if we're going to have that
talk. We do have that information.
Okay.
We have that in the Ways and Means Subcommittee.
Okay.
For Human Services. And so that's great information, and I will make sure, Keely, can they make sure that we get that for the committee? Good question.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, if I could just briefly say in response to Representative Dimbro's question, I think this is an unusual session, and I think about coming before your committee over the course of the last couple of weeks. The majority of the bills that I've come to bring to you are things that we've worked on. Clearly, the economy has changed, and what I've said to you is we probably can't afford it. I think it's good to get those ideas on the record, but I know that you will be weighing those, and I just want to reiterate again that if I had to choose between the tax credit things that were coming before you, I would really put, you know, all of my balls behind those, all of my chips behind the Carley's Law physician tax credits to provide those exams. Even though I think all of these things are worthy, or I wouldn't put my name on them, sadly we're in a situation where we can't afford to pay for a lot of things that are very important to a lot of Oregonians, and that's a disappointing thing, and I'm glad that you'll be carefully weighing those things in this committee. I know that's hard because you hear a lot of good things that are important to a lot of people.
Right. Thank you.
Madam Chair, can I just say, just for the record, too, and I didn't want to come across as being anti-adoption of kids from other places in the world, because I'm reminded of Senator now, Boquist, and how he got his daughter in from Afghanistan, I think it was. And that just blew me away when I heard that story, and I thought, you know, that's the kind of people who, you know, we represent our districts, and we want more of those people who will take a child who had no chance and probably would not be on this earth today had he not done that. So, and it's very, very valuable. And I think that the conversation we've been having today is very valuable. And I think that Representative Freeman touches a note. I think it's always preferable to have a child who can't, within foster care system, who can't be returned home to be adopted rather than moved around the system until they time out.
That.
I mean, they need a family.
Yes.
Very good, Representative.
And we did touch on it, but I'd like to reiterate that, you know, if we could possibly address this again on an Oregon scope as a savings
to
the state potentially, to move them out of the DHS expense into Loving Homes. So.
Is that something you'd be willing to work on, to perhaps bring an amendment to this bill to narrow it to that
Madam
group?
Madam Chair, I would love to. If two of my other committees, like education and another one, didn't have me so tied up on subcommittee work, I
understand. So
in
maybe
the
for the if we have another, not special session, supplemental session next year, perhaps that might be one that you could help us work on.
And I'm sure Representative Gelser would just love to work on that.
I always enjoy working with Representative Huffman.
Any further questions before we let Representative Gelser go? Thank you so much, Representative.
Thank you.
Anyone who wishes to testify on either of these two bills? Oh, we do have Mary Lee Faye, Catherine White, and Marcy
Engledew.
Ah, okay, I see that. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Catherine White, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities this morning. Just a couple comments. As Representative Gelser said, the issues of guardianship for people with developmental disabilities are extremely complex. They are very pressing and have become more pressing as the years have gone by, and we have not had a comprehensive look at the situation for many, many years. However, we are very much in support in not taking the route that this bill proposes, and are committed during this interim period to pull together a work group with the Developmental Disabilities Council. Disability Rights Oregon has agreed to be a part of it, and a number of organizations, including the state, to participate in really identifying critical issues, what are some potential solutions, and how we're going to address what is a lifetime issue of guardianship, not just a temporary end-of-life issue, but a lifetime issue of guardianship that we need to do a comprehensive review. So I just wanted to state that for the record, that we would be happy to come back at another time to talk about our recommendations with this committee, but we are committed to go forward and attempt to address many of the questions that were identified here.
Thank you, Catherine. I'm going to have the whole panel speak, and then we can ask questions.
Good morning, Representative Tomei and the members of the committee. My name is Marcy Engledew, and I'm the Executive Director for the Arc of Oregon, and I'm here today to address you on behalf of the organization, but also on behalf of one of our programs, the Guardianship Advocacy and Planning Service Program that we refer to as our GAPS program. If you're unfamiliar at all with the Arc of Oregon, we are a statewide membership organization, and we advocate for individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities and their families statewide. We've been in existence for over 50 years, and we've worked to create a better life for individuals with intellectual disabilities and their families. Our organization was founded by parents when there were no services, and we have a rich history of providing children and adults with advocacy and services. We're also affiliated at the national level with the Arc of the United States. In Oregon, we have 13 local chapters, and we have a grassroots membership statewide. We also are very proud of our partnerships with the disability community, and we work hard to help provide, make sure that there are services throughout the state. Initially, our GAPS program was funded by foundations, and it was established in 1978. It was when parents came to the Arc of Oregon and said, what's going to happen one day when we are no longer here? Who's going to take care of our children, our adult children, and what's going to happen to them? So the Arc of Oregon enlisted some foundations and provided some initial funding to provide not just guardianship, because we don't believe everyone needs a guardian, even though they have an intellectual disability. We provide health care rep services, and we provide advocacy services. Attached to my testimony, I've also added the position statement that the Arc of the United States has issued, and that the Arc of Oregon and all our local chapters support. So you have a little history of where we are, where our, what our position is for guardianship. Although our initial program was created to serve families and to have them name the ARC in their wills, probably currently only 10% of the individuals we serve are based on testamentary nominations and family wills. The majority of our services are for individuals that have absolutely no one, no family to serve them, no one that participates in their life. In the 1990s, the Department of Human Services established a small contract to address these issues, particularly for children aging out of the welfare system and or the foster care system into the adult system with no one as part of their lives. Currently, when that contract was established, that was for 25 individuals. With additional foundation funds and ongoing fundraising projects, the Arc of Oregon currently serves over 100 individuals in this program with staff located throughout Oregon. Only 4 of those individuals have their own funds to pay for our services. The rest are paid for by our fundraising and our contract. Since we've been in business since 1978, we know the need that's out there, and we're always surprised when we hear other people talk that they don't realize the issues. You're probably all aware of the abuse and neglect you've heard about over the past year or so that was in the public eye. We see that on a day-to-day basis in our program. We are greatly concerned because we need to address the issues. It's very hard for us as a program to receive referrals and to only take the most horrific abuse and neglect situations. Last year, we received 36 referrals, and we only accepted 6. That's not to say that those other 30, the majority of those, could have been served by our program if we would have had the capacity to deal with those. We also realize that right now over 17,000 individuals are enrolled in services in Oregon. Even if only 10% of those needed some sort of our service, that would be 1,700 individuals. Currently, our program serves 105. So we see that the need is great. But we do realize the economic times that we're in, and we do support the fact that this isn't the time to fund this bill. However, we are very anxious to work with DHS, with Disability Rights, with the Oregon Developmental Disabilities Coalition, as well as the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities, and we feel that we can pull individuals together to start looking at addressing some of these issues, and we feel that our program is a program that can really educate, because we've been working this program since 1978. We'd be a valuable resource to that committee, and so we look forward to working with those individuals and coming back later to maybe educate further on where guardianship is in our state. Thank you so much for letting me provide testimony today.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. I'm Mary Lee Fay. I'm the Administrator for Developmental Disabilities within Seniors and People with Disabilities, Department of Human Services. And I'm here to provide information on this bill. There is a fiscal attached to it, as both Representative Gelser mentioned and the other members. The list of issues to be looked at are very complex with far-reaching potential solutions and outcomes. And we do support the in lieu of the bill itself going forward with a task force to commit time with our members and our stakeholders to look at the prioritization of issues and really try and address many of the problems that are brought forward. Just as an aside, Marcy Ingledew mentioned that we currently have and have had a contract with the ARC for a number of years for a very small number of individuals. And when, just to give some picture of the complexity of the issues, when we started that, it was an assumption that we could support 25 to 30 individuals who were transitioning from having the state be involved because of child protective services to into their early adult years, because there were potential issues with family members who had been abusive and neglectful, to still trying to intervene in those young individuals' lives. Naively, we thought that as time went on, we could look to and those individuals stabilized and their circumstances really permitted, those individuals would move off the program and it would be a rotating type of program. But courts are not willing to vacate guardianships very easily. So one of the things we've realized with this program, and we continue to fund this, but it is a long-term program, that once there has been someone who's put in the role of taking on the guardianship for individuals, it is assumed that that really is a lifelong and long-term event. So we continue to work on issues. Our program and our states use a lot of planning teams and family members who don't necessarily have legal standing. And so as we look at the issues of how to identify, how to increase, and really come to be able to support people who really do need legal protection and legal advocacy, how we can incorporate that into our field is what we're really committed to looking at with our partners. So we will participate in the meetings and work that needs to be done in the interim.
Great. Thank you. Any questions of this panel? Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. I'm sitting here thinking this is kind of ironical, because the previous conversation we had on 2448, in essence, if they're not adopted, those are the people who we're talking about with this bill. Is that correct?
Chair Tomei and Representative Van Orman, primarily we're talking about individuals who now become adults. So
But that's what I'm saying, is that if they're not adopted, they will go through the system of guardianship as children, and then eventually they will have to be moved into adult guardianship?
Representative Tomei and Representative Van Orman, the process, as individuals, no matter whether they are the family is their guardian until they're 18, no matter what. And in Oregon, at 18, you are then legally your own guardian. For people with developmental disabilities, unless someone takes a legal action to say, I ask the court to actually be legally responsible in the decision-making, those individuals are their own guardians. And we've used a system where teams often help in some of those decision-making, but legally, they represent themselves.
Okay.
Any further questions? thank you. Yes,
Catherine. Madam Chair, I just wanted to make one other comment just in terms of the way things have changed. One of the issues that families run into who have their children at home and have their adult children with disabilities are even issues like HIPAA, which they may not even be able to get access to the information unless they are guardians. There have been some changes in IDEA, the education statutes that set situations up that kind of push families to guardianship, even when it perhaps may not be appropriate. So part of what we are looking to do in this group is really to come out with some guidelines that will help families make those decisions on when guardianship is appropriate, and help agencies understand the roles of families and the limitations or advantages of guardianship. Guardianship is not an inexpensive process. It requires hiring of lawyers, often, at least in some areas of the state, court visitors. It is an expensive process, and it is not one we do lightly. So I just wanted to add that information.
Thank you, Catherine. Any further questions? I think this is a very sobering issue, and I think it's going to be unlikely that we're going to be able to fund this task force as has been asked, but I would hope that the concerned people, the stakeholders in this, will be getting together so that eventually you could be coming back to this committee to deal with these very important and difficult issues.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yep. Did anyone else wish to testify on this? Bob, I see you there. Did you wish to testify on either of these two bills? Okay.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative.
Just a quick comment that while I understand that and appropriately, this particular bill was focused on people with developmental disabilities, there are other guardianship issues that are floating out there unresolved, mm-hmm. too. And we will probably be seeing another bill coming to us that deals with guardianship issues for seniors.
Right.
And because Bob is in the room at this moment, I'd like to recognize the willingness of his organization to step up and be part of this conversation. They will play a role in a future conversation about guardianship for seniors as well, and it does appear to me that the collective communities who have concern about people with some of these very special needs and areas that we're not addressing well are certainly coming together, and this is it's very encouraging. It's very disappointing to me that we're not able to stand behind perhaps some of those efforts as a state right now, but any legwork that's done until the day that we can step in and be a little more helpful will be very much appreciated as well.
Absolutely. Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair. May I have a question for Representative Cowan? Does that mean that at some point we could look at a bill that talks about guardianship in total, or are we going to be splitting it out as guardianship for people with disabilities, guardianship for adults? Do you have any idea?
Madam Chair?
Thank you.
I think at this point in time it will be appropriate and necessary for folks to focus on the specific needs of particular groups of individuals because those needs are very different. As Representative Gelzer explained, the needs that are lifelong for an individual with a developmental disability who has need of guardianship is different than the needs of a aging individual who may have a relatively short-term end-of-life need for interventions, and financial and some of the other challenges are a bit different. But I think the fact that folks can kind of collectively look at that and then hopefully be able to help us get our minds around that, even if it's in a future session, about what the differences, what the similarities, and what we need to do, some answers to those questions that I think you and others are struggling with right now.
Okay, thank you.
I'm going to... There's Yes, please. Yes, you may. Please just give us your name. Identify yourself.
My name is Jeff Brandon. I'm from Lake Oswego, and I'm a member of the Governor's Commission on Senior Services. I just want to clarify a point that Representative Cowan just made about this other bill that's floating around out there. It's going to be sponsored by Representative Cowan. And your chief of staff has given me a number now, an HB. Can I release that, or is that still preliminary?
May I respond to this?
Representative Cowan, yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's premature at this point because the bill will need to be assigned by the speaker to a committee. It is our assumption it will come to this committee, and we'll talk about it there. But it hasn't been publicized for hearing, and so it would probably not be appropriate to speak about a specific bill.
Okay.
To elaborate on some of what you're trying to do, if the chair is willing, is perfectly appropriate.
Right.
Since we're discussing guardianship,
it is related to that.
Broader manner, maybe this would be relating.
Right. But I can answer Representative Van Orman's question here. The endeavor we've been working on for the last couple of years started with the Governor's Commission on Senior Services and then went into a series of workshops sponsored by SPD this summer on the issue of public guardianship. So really floating around Salem right now are two task force. Representative Gelser's bill, which you just considered, and then our hopefully bill, which will be out any hour almost, a task force on public guardianship. But on this one, we're looking at the entire system, the existing law on public guardianship, and how the Oregon system works, and then we hope to be able to look at the whole national picture for public guardianship. But I need to be very clear on one point, that public guardianship is for adults over 18 of all disabilities. There is no division between seniors and DD and mental health and brain injury and dementia and Alzheimer's, et cetera, et cetera. I am retired now, but I worked 25 consecutive years in the public guardian office in Multnomah County, and I can tell you that my caseload all those years was at least half DD and mental health, and then the rest seniors. So guardianship in Oregon is for all disabilities, and that's why we're looking at the entire system, and we'd be very happy to work with Representative Gelser and look at how DD and mental health fit into that. And also I'd like to say that we are having conversations with Bob Jundeff and Disability Rights Oregon about our bill, which again we will not ask for money because there is none in Salem. We will be looking for a grant to fund this study for 2 years.
Good. Thank you very much. Any questions of this gentleman? Thank you very much for coming to testify today.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else who wishes to talk about either of these two bills? Then I will close the public hearing on 2443 and 2448. And colleagues, before we close, I want you to note I'm on the Ways and Means Sub for Human Services. The issues that we discuss there are so different from the issues we discuss here, because it has to do with what the state is financing. We hear a much broader array of issues that is just fascinating to me. And some of these, of course, will eventually go to Ways and Means. But we have a huge responsibility to deal with all kinds of human service activities throughout our state, and sometimes I'm just amazed at something that I'd never thought of, such as guardianship. It was not on my radar, and how much we have learned today, and how much of a responsibility we have to hopefully deal with this in the future. So I just wanted to share that with you.
Madam Chair, I'm really appreciative of the fact that you're on that Ways and Means Committee.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's probably the heart of my frustration as we deal with some of these individual issues as policy questions and whether we're going to pass something along to spend a little more on. But we don't have an opportunity in this committee to talk about those really, really vital services that are currently being provided
mm-hmm.
by DHS and whether they're going to be adequately, we're going to be able to adequately support them and the impacts of what will happen if we don't. In fact, we'll have another little small bill that basically deals with asking for some tracking of that as we worry about the number of particularly my area of interest, seniors and people mm-hmm. with physical disabilities who may no longer be able to receive services in this current budget climate, and then we just lose them. How do we track those individuals? I mean, how do we have some way of knowing what ultimately happens to
right.
people when we make those difficult decisions? So thank you for staying on top of that. I think that many of the rest of us are very interested as well and can't quite figure out how to follow everything.
Well, it's been a fascinating process. And for those of our freshmen, you don't realize that it was only this session that the chairs of the substantive committees are now on the Ways and Means Committee. Before, there was a disconnect, and there would be completely different testimony in this meeting as in Ways and Means. So now there's more of a connection, which is...
That's a great idea.
Excellent.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you. I thought so, too.
Madam Chair,
yeah.
Is that true of your Senate counterparts as well? Are the chairs of the Senate committees also on the Ways and Means?
I don't know.
Some are, I think.
I don't know. That's a good question.
Because then we would be perfectly logical.
Yes, indeed.
Well, it doesn't fall.
<at all. laughs>
not every committee chair is on a Ways and Means committee.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry to hear that.
What did you say? I'm sorry.
Not every committee chair is on the Associated Ways and Means Committee. I think there's probably not enough
sometimes
spots.
Maybe the scheduling is difficult.
Could be.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, before we go, I'd like to pick up and thank you for what you said about this committee, and it just reminds me of, it is connected, but on a very small scale, what we're doing is what used to happen, especially in our rural areas, is people pretty much looked out for their neighbors, and when someone was sick or had a problem or broke their leg or something, the neighbors would all come together and someone would cook for the family, someone would do the work out in the fields or whatever it was. Or in the woods. And I think that's what we're looking at. If we could update that paradigm and let our constituents and our people know that there's not a better time. And Representative Dembro brought up the French model in the bill we heard earlier, and you know we can learn a lot from the French. It's a village. It's called you know, living by the village, and it happens in a lot of areas around the world anyway. And our country is we've been so disconnected. I think it's time to start connecting again.
I was thinking of that family connection when they were talking about the French model too. I thought, well, that's what we used to do.
We used to do that
with families.
Yeah.
But we've grown apart.
Yeah. Indeed.
We've
divorced
really ourselves. Well, I won't get
it. It's another discussion, yeah.
Yeah, I could get you on another subcommittee.
Someday I'll learn.
I hope not. With that, thank you all, and I close the House Committee on Human Services.